reasons why one cares about a city. Why you care about its problems, its people, and indeed its very future. Is it friendly, warm, hospitable? And are there good job opportunities, educational facilities, and a cultural center? Are you proud to call it your hometown? When you come right down to it, I venture to say you'll all agree to a resounding yes when you're talking about Detroit, my hometown.
Robinson and the Miracles with their 1968 Motown anthem to their beloved city, I Care About Detroit. It was a different time. Today, as we've been discussing over the past few years, Detroiters are trying their very best to hold on to their city, but they're up against a system that wants them gone. The battle, however, is day by day, block by block. And today we hear from grassroots soldiers about ongoing battles. Today, you should know, is the revival of the Poor People's Campaign that Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had announced that they were going to conduct this campaign nationwide to bring awareness to the fact that there were two Americas, one white, one black, and both separate and unequal. We're talking about the revival. With that as a background today, we're talking about the Poor People's Campaign today as it launches again. And we are going to talk just the same about fights that have been ongoing. It isn't that the struggle had died. There are many struggles across the country that kept on going. And that is where we're going today with Detroit, the city of Detroit, a case in point. We'll talk first with Elena Herrada, a very familiar voice here on Lead Stories, an elected member of Detroit's old school board whose authority over local education unconstitutionally was overridden by the state during the state-imposed bankruptcy of the city. And she's going to talk to us about the pushback that is coming specifically from the Mexican community against the Trump administration's racist, anti-immigrant policies, especially as they relate to forced repatriation. Thanks so much, Elena, for being with us again today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, and it's really an honor to be called the grassroots soldier. There is no better place to be.
I share that sentiment, of course. I certainly do. Well, on this day, when this effort, the Poor People's Campaign, is re-energizing and refocusing, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's really important, and I'm really happy that Michigan is one of the 25 states involved in the Poor People's Campaign. When Reverend Barber, who was the director of the NAACP in North Carolina, came to Detroit as part of his campaign in the last couple of years, we kept asking him, how do you do this Moral Monday? How do you get all those people to go to the state capitol and get arrested? We couldn't get people to come to the school board meeting down the street. And he said it took years and years and years. And I said, we need to do that. We need to shut down the Capitol. We need to shut down this corrupt legislature, because we really are in a rogue state. We're in a rogue state. When this governor, Snyder, can lie to a congressional committee about poisoning the people of Flint, knowingly poisoning the people, and knowingly misleading them into thinking that they were safe to drink water, then we are in a rogue state. But only the black and brown communities have been really directly impacted having our votes taken away through the emergency manager laws. And when we repealed that law, we simply got it back that was voter-proof, because Michigan in the legislature has a process for making things referendum-proof by adding what's called appropriations to it, which is simply a $10,000 budget addition, which is our own money used against us, so that something can't be repealed by the voters. So that's what they did. So we repealed the law that was racist on the face of it, that only impacted disenfranchising the black and brown communities. And then when we repealed it statewide, that's all the voters statewide, then we got it back again. And that is the law that was used to be able to, for example, build the stadium, Little Caesars Arena, for a multi-billionaire, Mike Ilitch Holdings, and take that money from school tax captures. So our school system was broke. We were forced to take a loan because the state had taken it over and spent $3.2 billion in bond money. And while they had the power, while they continued to wield the power of the state, they built a stadium for which Ilitch will have in perpetuity all of the profits while that money is taken away from public schools, which means that we're relegated to an impoverished school system in perpetuity, because we built him that stadium. That's just an example of the kind of racist laws that have been imposed and the way in which we have no avenue of recourse in the courts or at the ballot box. So that's something that really needs to be understood by the people listening, is that Detroit was not bankrupt. A bankruptcy law firm took us over and filed for bankruptcy. That was Kevin Orr, that was Judge Rhodes, who then went on to Puerto Rico. So we have been stripped of all of our authority and all of our power, not because of our mishandling of money, but because corporate interests wanted our public assets, and they've got them now. So to that end, I want to really congratulate the Poor People Campaign, and Melissa Mays, the warrior from the Flint water struggles, is the spokesperson today for the Michigan press conference that was held. So they're asking for 25 states to have at least 1,000 people ready to be arrested, ready to do civil disobedience, ready to shut down the legislature in order to be able to take back the higher moral ground. So I know that's a lot to think in right now, but
now people are under the impression that between today and the time this first was launched as the Poor People's Campaign, there wasn't much happening, that it went underground or something. And I'm saying today that the response to the system, this racist system, might have been erratic, but it certainly did not die.
Right. Right. It hasn't disappeared at all. The people have been working for years and years. The Poor People's Campaign here in Michigan is made up of a coalition of groups like Welfare Rights Organization and the General Baker Institute and many other, the Flint people, many people statewide. It hasn't, it's just coming together and culminating as a campaign, and it's going to have 40 days of action in the coming days.
But I have to ask a question. I'm sure that you would agree that when we had Democratic administrations, and most recently the Obama administration, we didn't see too much of a public outcry against the injustices that were being done to black and brown communities across the nation. There was a sense of embarrassment about it, or not wanting to embarrass the Democratic administration. Do you find that it is also a little bit ironic that now that Trump has upped the ante, now we're seeing the rebirth, if you will, or the revitalization of the Poor People's Campaign?
I think that that's true. I do think that we live under an empire, and it doesn't really matter much who's in charge of it. I think that President Obama did. I can't speak for him, and I don't know him, but I'm pretty sure that he didn't do a lot of the things that he wanted to do, and he did do a lot of things that he didn't want to do. I also want to say that close to 11 million people living undocumented in the United States is a record number of people living undocumented in the United States, living illegally. There were different periods in history when we didn't have the border. We didn't have quotas. We had different quotas at different times. But there was nothing like the kind of migration that came from a central place, like the Global South, since NAFTA, which forced people out of Mexico and Central America. Force people north to be able to come, and then we're criminalized for trying to survive. And those are the people that we're fighting now to defend under DACA and under other. Not everybody's DACA. You know, there's a lot of people who are not eligible for DACA, like Jorge Garcia, who you see about in the news all the time. There are a lot of people who are just falling through all of the incredible rips in the safety net. And I'm not defending the deportations by any means, but I am saying that every single country in the world is dealing with migration, outward, inward migration. We're not looking at the root causes of it. Everybody just wants to suddenly become a national sort of country. There's this nativism that's going on that says America first, like really? And all of these kinds of things that are going on when people did not volunteer to leave their homes. They didn't want to have to leave, but they were forced to leave, and now they're being forced out of the place where they came to make a life. All of this is going on as a result of political events and climate change. These are things that people are acting in ways that they're forced to act in ways over which they have no control. So for everybody to be treated as an individual who's breaking the law under a completely lawless order is insanity. And this is what I think most people of goodwill are rising up against. That's what we're really
Detroit
doing.
Has a particularly interesting story to tell about the issue of immigration. And it concerns the Mexican community, of which you are a part, and your parents were a part. Could you start telling us about how you see this developing?
Well, you know, the repatriation of Mexicans occurred a couple times in history, but the most intense time was between 1929 and 1939. And that was the time when most of our families came north. They came because they were recruited to work at Ford for $5 a day. It was a time when everyone was coming here to work in the auto plants or in the places that supported the auto plants. So places like Detroit, Lafayette, Gary, Indiana, Chicago, all throughout the industrial centers, Mexicans came to work. And during that period of time, the Depression hit. And there was the repatriation was done as a result of that kind of America first sort of ethos that was permeating the country by saying that Mexicans didn't have a right to be here, even though Mexicans had been recruited to come here. Nobody would have known about Henry Ford's $5 a day if Henry Ford hadn't gone and recruited. So our families came in between 1929 and 1939. A million Mexicans across the country were deported to Mexico, and 15,000 out of Detroit. At that time, 15,000 Mexicans was a lot of people to be in Detroit at that time. And we ended up with 4,000 people by about 1932. And it took us many years to recover, for the community to have more people than that. It took until NAFTA for us to recover, the sending forces of migration. So our families were among those who returned. Our families were, came back over a kind of a period of years and trickled back in. And it wasn't until the 70s that many of us even learned that that had happened. We didn't even know that Mexicans got kicked out, of 60% of whom were U.S. born. They were just like the people now who are getting deported. They have U.S. born children, and their children are being denied their birthright of being born in the U.S. And some of the people never returned. Some of them lived in Mexico and stayed there. But we did a short documentary on it called Los Repatriados, Exiles from the Promised Land. And in that documentary, we interview people who were those who had returned, and also those who had never returned. So that is getting new life now, because we're trying to show the younger people that that there was a struggle before them, that there was a struggle for the right to citizenship, and that there was a struggle for the right to live with dignity, no matter where you are, no matter where you're born. So this is a sort of a renewed theme that we're showing to our community now. We've been having screenings of the film that we created in 2001 in order to be able to encourage the young people from now.
How is that struggle going?
Well, I accompanied a young woman to court last week who was an unaccompanied minor from Guatemala, and she was given a court date of 2019. And that to me was surprisingly hopeful. She crossed by herself at 16 because of the terrible conditions of her home country. And I just go with her to court and go with her to various appointments and help translate just as a neighbor. And I've been watching closely the developments of how the unaccompanied minors are being treated. It's shocking to me that they are considered a priority for deportation. They're children, and they in many cases have paid $4,000 and $5,000 to coyotes and gone into tremendous debt. People who make $3 a day are owing money to people who have access to their families in their home countries, people who help them cross. So there's a tremendous amount of danger involved, and they're not eligible for asylum. They're not necessarily eligible for any kind of particular status. They're just, you know, waiting for a date to be deported, or waiting for, you know, just wait. They just go day by day. There's tremendous, tremendous precariousness in Detroit now for black, white, brown, everyone. Tremendous precariousness because of the situation with the banks, the foreclosures, the bankruptcy, the water shutoffs. This is our promised land, and people are really scrambling just to survive day to day.
Well, I wanted to explore that a little bit more, because you kind of cross all these lines on a daily basis. So you have a sense of, you know, the panorama of the distress in Detroit. Do you have a sense that people are beginning now to see that they have quite a lot in common in terms of fighting a common enemy, and they are beginning to galvanize the efforts to fight back?
I do, and I think the Poor People's Campaign is an excellent example of that. I think that that's a national phenomena, and people are gathering locally as well. I do think that that's an excellent model for organizing. and especially for people willing to do civil disobedience, because we really have no avenue of redress here. We have no avenue of redress.
Well, that brings me to the question about Detroit being a very heavily Democratic, a bastion of Democratic politics.
That and the buck will get you a cup of coffee.
In these years that we've been talking about Detroit, we also keep referencing the fact that the political parties seem to have dropped the ball and continue to drop the ball here. They're not in the thick of this action, and instead they show up only to appeal for popular support. But in the heat of battle, they're missing. Has that changed?
We have an extremely corrupt administration right now who, I would say, having been a witness to the election, and I participate in electoral politics deeply. I participate from the grassroots level to school board meetings, to everything else. I participate deeply in the voting process in Detroit. To me, it's something that is our absolute province of, it's got to be, we have to have access to the right to vote. You're either despairing by not voting, or you're, even if our vote turns up empty, if 60% of our votes go missing like they have in Detroit, if a write-in candidate who's put up by billionaires, who's white, who is beloved by nobody in Detroit, gets to be the mayor two terms in a row, your process is so corrupt, but it doesn't mean that we're going to abandon it. I really take a lot of cues from Mexico on this. Mexico, the candidates are always under fire. Some of them are so corrupt. Some of them are put up by the U.S. But the people always participate in Mexican politics. I don't think that people ever give up on their right to vote, on their right to participate. It's a human right. It's a responsibility. So I do think that it's something that, even though we never win, even though good people can't get on the ballot, even though we don't have, if racial representation is a part of it, I would say it's sufficient, but not, it's necessary, but not sufficient. We have black people who sell us out, Latinos who sell us out, white people who sell us out. I think that that is actually a very equal opportunity kind of thing. But we do never give up. We never give up. And I think it's really important for people to take heart and continue to follow the issues, pay close attention to what's going on, follow our money, even if we know it's getting stolen right in front of our faces. We still have to at least own it and know it and call them out. I call them out. Never stop calling them out. Even when they break into our house and steal our computers, even when they kick in the front door, because they play hardball here, I'm telling you. You cannot give up.
What then would you blame somebody who says, look, we've been down this road many times before. We've been through too many cycles of this same thing where we do the right thing and there are 15,000 different ways to undermine us. It's time for something else. What is the something else?
I don't know what something else is. I know people talk trash about each other when they want to talk about a third party. I'd be happy for a second party. But, it would be really, like whatever people can come up with, I'm willing to go along with any kind of harebrained scheme that shows the possibilities or that shows that people are not giving up and that they still have hope.
I want to know what's next in this repatriation program. At what point is it now? Has it reached a point of critical mass, or has the U.S. backed off a bit?
I think that it will. But when look at how you, I keep thinking about this. Like I heard that a number that 200,000 Salvadorans lost protective status and were getting deported. Really fast deportations are going on of people who have lived here for 20 and 30 years. I can't help but wonder what the impact is of 200,000 people going to returning to a country the size of Rhode Island, who have been, you know, relatively safe from terror. That's got to change the landscape of any place they're going, and it changes here where they're leaving. I'm wondering what's going to happen with millions of Mexicans returning to Mexico who have been living here, who speak English, who have, you know, all kinds of different skills. People who, I mean, the world is going to be changing in ways that we hadn't even considered with all of these people being shuffled around different countries in the world. It's going to change. Don't you notice every time you have an experience from going somewhere else, how transformative it is to you when you return home? I mean, I just think that I actually am hopeful. I'm hopeful for all the people who are being moved around.
In this time, in as much as we have the Declaration of the Poor People's Campaign 2.0, what would you encourage people to do?
I would encourage people definitely to check it out. If you know, in whatever way you can, through look at what the Poor People's Campaign is doing. And if you're in one of the states, the states that were chosen to participate are the ones who were deemed to have the highest poverty rates among children and the greatest voter suppression. So those 25 states were selected as sort of hot spots. That's how we got in. That's how we qualified. But from wherever you are and from wherever you're listening, pay attention to it because it's a really good model. Civil disobedience is going to be the only avenue that we have to make any kind of change because nothing else is working. Things have been brought, everything is bought and paid for. There's nothing that we can do with the courts, with the ballot box. I'm telling you here, it's, my daughter and my grandson corrected me in saying that we can't call this a failed state, but this is a rogue state. It's a rogue state. When we have a mayor who was the mayor of Detroit serving 28 years in prison for perjury and corruption, and a sitting mayor who does more than that every day before lunch, who's never going to be investigated. We have a governor who lied and poisoned thousands of people who are dying off every day and many who have already died of Legionnaires' disease and such, who doesn't have to respond to anybody. He actually removed the president of Michigan State University and is moving on to the universities to remove the directors, the governors. And I'll tell you, for people watching MSU and that Larry Nassar drama, I don't believe for a minute that anybody cared about those little girls. I believe that this was a moment that they saw that they could use that to seize the elected governors. There's only three universities left in Michigan that elect their boards of governors, and those three universities are not tied up with charter schools. Engler and Snyder are absolutely up to their eyeballs with Betsy DeVos. That's what this was about. Don't you think that they all of a sudden care about these little girls being exploited after 20 years? So we have everything that you see that happens in Michigan is happening for some other than the stated reason. It's nothing but corruption. It's a perversion of everything that people believed in. If we don't follow the story... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And still you're hopeful, and still you're.
I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful, and that's one of the reasons that I pay attention. I go on my little radio program. I do my Facebook. I do all that I can from a public platform. I've been blacklisted from here to hell, but I pay attention to everything that's going on and speak truth about it in ways that people can grasp. And I'm hoping that other people who have such access will do the same, and that other people who don't, our biggest job right now, I think in terms of just grassroots people, our greatest task is to ward off despair, because once we despair, we will succumb to anything. And I think it's really important to show we have to raise ourselves to higher ground. We have to constantly refuse to fight. And if they're gonna take us all and round us up, we better go down fighting. It's much better to go down fighting.
Better go down fighting. Thanks, Elena, for being with us. Always great to hear from you. And all the more so because in the midst of despair, you remain hopeful and you keep your nose to the grindstone. You don't give up. Thanks so much for
and
being with us today.
And don't forget to laugh. Thank you. All right.
Absolutely. You have to have a sense of humor. We go next to another familiar voice, and this voice belongs to Abayomi Azikiwe, who had been, if you recall, he had been coursing us through the timeline of Detroit, the city of Detroit, under an imposed bankruptcy and the fallout from that and related issues. Abayomi is editor-in-chief of the Pan-African Newswire and a Detroit organizer for the Workers' World Party and Moratorium Now, which is looking or has been fighting to ward off massive foreclosures going on in the city of Detroit. Abayomi, always great to have you on with us. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for the invitation once again.
Well, let's start with the latest insanity, the city of Detroit sending out an additional, brand new, 36,000 new notices to homeowners that they will face imminent foreclosure. Tell us a bit about that.
It's very interesting, considering the fact that last fall, right before the auction of less than 2,000 properties in the city, the Wayne County Treasurer, Eric Sabree, the Detroit Corporate Mayor, Mike Dugan, and a few others held a press conference to compliment themselves for reducing the number of foreclosures, property tax foreclosures, which in 2015, when we declared that it was a citywide and countywide emergency of about 40 to 50,000 potential property tax foreclosures to less than 2,000, it was all smoke and mirrors. What they've done, which has some positive elements within it, the fact that in 2015 they were forced to extend the deadlines. They were forced to allow people to get into payment plans. These extensions continued for several months, which bought time for many homeowners to not get evicted. The problem is poverty. The overall problem derives from the bank-engineered massive predatory lending schemes that Detroit was inflicted by beginning in the late 1990s and extending through the first half of the 2000s. This is really what has created this crisis. The actual values of property were artificially inflated in order to extend refinancing agreements and new homeowner purchasing programs to people knowing on the part of these financial institutions that these programs were unsustainable, that these loans would never be able to be paid back. So it just didn't happen here in Detroit. It happened all over the United States, but it had a particular impact here. And, of course, this eventually led to the financial crisis of 2007, 2008, 2009, where the federal government under former President George Bush and former President Barack Obama went to the taxpayers in the United States and extorted, beginning with over $700 billion to bail out the banks and the insurance companies, as well as two out of three of the auto firms. And then, of course, this bailout continued and still continues through various forms of quantitative easing, where they actually give Federal Reserve funds, which is our money as well, to the financial institutions to keep them propped up. So this drove up artificially the value of properties, and therefore the property taxes were artificially inflated. And people were just incapable of making these payments, even those who were able to save their homes from bank foreclosures. So we're still living with this crisis in 2018 as we speak. Now, the 36,000 notices that went out, and this was written about in the Metro Times several weeks ago. It's a weekly Detroit newspaper that's, interestingly enough, taken a highly critical position, editorial stance against not only Mike Dugan, but also Dan Gilbert, who's really the de facto mayor of Detroit, for their tax breaks and tax captures. So we haven't heard anything from the powers that be. They have been very silent on this question because just 4 months ago, they were praising themselves. So we have to, in fact, go out again and wage another campaign to try to save people's homes here in Detroit. The problem is that you have virtually starvation wages among a lot of people within the working class, and the property taxes are way too high, and they're using these property taxes to actually facilitate the day-to-day operations of Wayne County through the auction process. So it's really a criminal enterprise, in our estimation.
Well, you know, I was reading and came up on a study that was done just last year that found a whopping 85% of homes in Detroit were being illegally taxed.
Yes.
Under Michigan law. In the state of Michigan, a property should not be taxed at a rate higher than 50% of its market value. And they are finding that in all of these foreclosures that have already gone, those that are currently being threatened, that these homes have been targeted and compelled to pay taxes that in fact defy Michigan law. What is happening with that?
Well, the Michigan American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, filed a lawsuit during the summer of 2016, along with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and one private law firm as well. And it's being held up, stalled within the Michigan court system, because they realize that this case is allowed to go forward, and even some type of negotiated settlement is reached, it could really bring down the state government and the county and city municipal structures, because it's all based on inflated assessments of property taxes and the consequent auction of properties that are foreclosed, the ones that can be auctioned. So what happened was that the chief judge for Wayne County, who in most cases rules in favor of the banks and against homeowners and working class people in general, he took the position that the court did not have the authority to rule on whether or not the assessments were unconstitutional. Well, this is an amazing ruling, and said that perhaps the Michigan Tax Tribunal should hear the case. Well, it's counterintuitive to say that a tax tribunal should address state constitutional issues. So the case was appealed to the state appeals court in Michigan, and they upheld the lower court's ruling. So right now the case is stalled in the Michigan court system, and the assessments, although going forward, there has been some reduction, but it doesn't address what has happened in previous years. The people who have lost thousands upon thousands of dollars through a tax system that is unconstitutional and unjust, there's no redress for that population, at least in the state courts. Now, perhaps they could take it into the federal courts, but even that could take years. And they're utilizing the not only the Michigan State Constitution, but also the Fair Housing Act of 1968 that was passed 50 years ago, right in the aftermath of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So these are issues that, in our opinion, will have to be fought out in the political arena. These are real, even though they have tremendous socioeconomic impact, at the core of it, these are political decisions that have been made not to pursue the banks from a legal standpoint and a criminal standpoint, who created the housing crisis, not only in Detroit and Michigan, but throughout the United States. This is a conscious move on the part of the federal government not to pursue these elements for their criminal behavior, and also not to impose a indefinite moratorium until the housing crisis can be adequately resolved. So these are political decisions that have been made by the rulers at the aegis of the banks and the corporations which benefit from loans and other types of incentives from the financial community.
Well, we saw the greatest damage done under a Democratic administration of Barack Obama. We saw the annihilation, the targeting and annihilation of black neighborhoods, brown neighborhoods all throughout the state. We saw imposed management by the state, unilateral imposition of controls in, and most, if not all, of these cities were black and brown cities. So it's hard to ignore the racial implications here. Insofar as this has been pointed out, and to embarrassing degrees, I imagine, has anything changed at all at the state level or even at the federal level to revisit this phenomenon, because we see it as a planned effort to empty the city of its, quote, undesirable populations, unquote, and to serve as a kind of template for how this same program of targeted emptying could be replicated in other cities that will, you know, they'll go through a rough period of transition, but in any event, they'll come out on the other side as winners.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point that you're making. And it didn't necessarily start with Barack Obama. We have to go back to the Clinton administration to really get a broader perspective on this, when they actually engineered the destruction of public housing in many cities throughout the United States. Chicago was a particular target during the 1990s. And this, of course, was coupled with other policies of the Clinton administration, which was a Democratic administration, such as, quote, the elimination of welfare as we know it, unquote, the placing of more police on the streets and urban areas, the passage of the notorious crime bill, the Effective Death Penalty Act, and other policies that came out of a Democratic administration. And a lot of people were dislocated in Chicago and in Detroit. Now, if we fast forward to the Obama years, we can see as well the whole anti-union mentality that was prevalent, particularly within the school system under Obama. They were, people have to remember, they were champions of charter schools. They were anti-education unions. And what was really interesting that in 2012, when there was a teacher strike in Chicago, they rapidly settled the strike because it was an election year. However, at the same time, the deterioration of the school system in Chicago and in Detroit is continuing. Now, in regard to emergency management, when we had gone into court in 2013 to challenge the legality of the imposition of bankruptcy through the federal courts, the Justice Department, under Barack Obama, issued a brief upholding what they perceived to be the constitutionality of the entire process. So this was clear that they were on board with this, quote, restructuring, unquote, of the city of Detroit and other majority African-American cities throughout the state of Michigan, which resulted in the cutting of pensions, the virtual destruction of health care programs for retirees, which had been negotiated. And they blamed the so-called excessive legacy cost as the reason behind the bankruptcy. And we challenged that in the courts and in the streets, that the real culprits for the financial demise of Detroit were the banks through their predatory lending in the housing industry, as well as municipal finance. We exposed the interest rate swaps, the termination fees that actually drove the city to the brink of financial insolvency. We were able to defeat the most egregious interest rate swap deal, which they wanted to pay off, Kevin Orr and Jones Day. That was defeated. That saved the city over $200 million. However, we were not able, we were able to stop the initially proposed cuts to pensions, which were about 86% cuts. It went down to about 4.5% for the general pension fund and ostensibly zero for the police and fire fund. However, that was enough money for them to at least put on a facade of some type of restructuring. The privatization of the public lighting system, the privatization of the Detroit Public Works, the establishment of a trust around the Detroit Institute of Arts, and other measures. However, this is not sustainable, obviously. And what I wanted to mention, too, which is really, really almost sad, is that Amazon, one of the largest corporations in the world, was considering coming to the city of Detroit recently to establish a, I think, their second headquarters. And Dugan and the city council had offered huge tax breaks for them and other incentives, and they turned it down. Detroit didn't even make the short list. And what was the reason that they articulated? Was some of the same issues that we've been talking about for several years. Lack of public transportation, problems associated with housing, the educational system. These apparently, either they've been reading our websites or they sent some very objective observers here to ride around the city, and they made an assessment that they did not want to move to the city of Detroit. So this blows away this whole narrative that's being promoted on a national and international level. Detroit now is ready for business. It's on the upswing. And, you know, just come on into Detroit and you're bound to make profit. So, yes, the Obama administration was clearly on board for this entire process. And today, under the Trump administration, we have what people talked about in the 70s, benign neglect. Patrick Moynihan, if you remember, who had been the great liberal.
It's not entirely benign. We see the systematic emptying, the targeting of communities to empty them. And, you know, I wondered whether you see a parallel here between the systematic targeting and emptying of so-called undesirable communities in order to transform racially and economically, transform particular communities so that they become revenue centers. Whether you see the connection with what's happening in Puerto Rico, the systematic emptying of Puerto Rico using the ruse of, well, it was a really horrible storm and it will take some time to get back to Puerto Rico the way it used to function. But in fact, what they systematically are doing, because there have been cases, meetings in federal court in San Juan and federal court in New York City, where the real estate interests and the insurance interests have begun discussions on how to carve up Puerto Rico.
Most definitely. The same players are involved. Some of the same financial institutions, hedge funds, securitized trusts are involved in Puerto Rico that are also involved in the city of Detroit. Jones Day Corporation, which engineered the pseudo-legal bankruptcy that we were impacted by in 2013 and 2014, are also involved in Puerto Rico. Judge Rhodes, who as a judge was supposed to be objective, has also been serving as a consultant in Puerto Rico as well. And Puerto Rico now is facing, from the recent reports that I've read, a housing crisis of unprecedented magnitude because they put a 60-day stay on foreclosures, which has been lifted. And Puerto Rico is dominated by colonial capitalist power, i.e. The United States, particularly Washington and New York. And if you contrast Puerto Rico and what's happening in Cuba, there's really no comparison. You know, I had some colleagues that went to Cuba several months ago, and the power has been completely restored. They said there was very little evidence that a horrendous hurricane had hit Cuba because the society is organized and it's a people-centered political system. Where in Puerto Rico, they are deliberately neglecting or ignoring the essence of the problem. Trump had the gall to even say that Puerto Rico is bringing about a lot of expenditures as far as the United States Treasury is concerned. And he had absolutely no interest in doing anything for Puerto Rico. It's not clear what FEMA, the National Guard, and the U.S. military is actually doing there in regard to hurricane relief. And still now, a lot of people in Puerto Rico do not have electrical power. So, yes, here in Puerto Rico, an oppressed nation, here you have a black oppressed nation in the United States, Detroit, of course, being the largest per capita African-American populated city in the United States. Over 80% of the population are black. We have a rising brown population as well, Middle Eastern population. So we, in a sense, we're under a similar type of colonial arrangement. So yes, the similarities are quite striking.
I imagine so. How has your group, Moratorium Now, which is seeking an end to water shutoffs and foreclosures, what progress are you making?
Well, it's amazing that people are still showing up every week to our meetings. Even in this cold weather, we're still getting a lot of people who are showing up. People want to hold a conference on March 24th. To develop a program to fight this austerity that's being advanced right now from Washington, D.C. and from Wall Street. And that conference is actually going to take place on March the 24th at a area historic African-American church, St. Matthew, St. Joseph Church, on Woodward Avenue in the north end section of Detroit, which is being targeted as well for gentrification. And they want to expand it to a national conference because this process is taking place in many other cities throughout the United States. There will be water crisis, the raising of rents, the systematic dispersal of black communities and brown communities. It's going on in New York City. It's happening in Baltimore. It's happening in Chicago. It's happening in New Orleans, Los Angeles, the Bay Area of California, and so forth. So we have been moving forward in that direction. We also have, as I told you 3 years ago, was able to stave off a much larger crisis in regard to housing. But these are temporary stopgap measures. It's more like buying time, so to speak. Until the whole question of poverty is addressed in this country, there's not going to be any long-term solution. And if you listen to President Trump's State of the Union address last week. I mean, if you had the stomach to sit through it, the word poverty is never mentioned. And just the falsehood that he enunciates consistently, for example, saying that the unemployment rate among African Americans is the lowest in history, just totally false.
Oh, please. Oh, please.
I mean, World War II, when the overall unemployment rate in the United States was down to 1.2% because of the draft and because of the war industry. So
he's working his way back to zero unemployment for blacks, as in the days of slavery. I think
exactly.
That's what his program is. We have to leave it there for today. But Abayomi, I mean, between you and Elena Herrada, we have so much reason to keep the faith, so much reason to continue to do whatever we can to turn back these devilish hands that are meaning us no good. And I thank you for your work you do, and thank you for being with us today.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. We'll see each other tomorrow. Great program coming.
Are you proud to call it your hometown? When you come right down to it, I'd venture to say you'll all agree to a resounding yes when you're talking about Detroit, my hometown.